Deutschlandfunk Kultur Breitband.
Das ist das Bonusmaterial zur Breitbandausgabe vom 5. Januar 2019. Wir haben mit dem Internetkritiker Jaron Lanier gesprochen.
Ja, unsere Kollegin Maike Love hat ihn getroffen. Wir haben das ganze Interview übersetzt und auch so ein bisschen kommentiert. In unserer Sendung lässt sich alles nachhören auf breitband.deutschlandfunkkultur.de. Und hier gibt es jetzt nochmal die unkommentierte und unübersetzte 1:1 Variante auf Englisch. Maike Love im Gespräch mit Jaron Lanier.
You've been like a very vocal critic of a lot of developments surrounding the Silicon Valley. Yeah. Having spent a lot of time there, or at least like in the scene, so you can have like a long-term observation of what did happen there, what ruined it.
Oh, well, this is controversial. In my opinion, what ruined it is simple. It's a bad idea for a business plan. And the business plan that I think was the ruination is called the advertising business plan. But that's not an accurate description. It's not advertising such as we've been familiar with on billboards or in newspapers or TV. Instead, a person is put under constant surveillance and all of this information from the person is taken and used by algorithms to construct a constantly changing, customized experience for the person. And that experience uses principles from the science of behaviorism to create an addiction effect and an ability to modify the person. And the only way to make money is for some third party to pay into the system in the belief that they'll modify the people who are using the system. So the entire business becomes about manipulation. Everything becomes dishonest. Everything becomes sneaky. Everything becomes inhumane very quickly. And people develop the personality side effects that come along with addictions on a mass basis. So this is the problem. I mean, I think this is very clearly the problem. And I think more and more people are agreeing with that assessment. It was a time when my opinion was considered radical, but at this point, I would say it's probably mainstream.
But what started this? Is this decision the origin of sin? Because there are a lot of different explanations I found in your most recent, at least German book, The Dawn of the New Everything, which says like, maybe a bad starting point was in the beginning of the 90s where we started to build systems around bits, not humans. Another starting point would be like the libertarian turn a lot of Silicon Valley people chose.
Well, you know, I think one thing that is clear is that this problem did not come about because of a decision in isolation by a few executives at companies like Google or Facebook. I think that the overall tech culture and tech community essentially forced them to accept it. I don't think they had any choice realistically. And there were the reasons for that were that there were two contradictory belief systems, each of which became orthodoxies, and that left very little room for creativity. One of the belief systems was that everything should be free, sort of a socialist idea for anything on the internet. And in Europe, that idea found its expression both in the open software movement with things like Linux and also with the pirate parties and many other examples. So that was one orthodoxy. And that by itself, I think, would have led to possibly a reasonable internet. But it was combined with this other orthodoxy, which is sort of an idol worship, this worship of high-tech entrepreneurs and super hackers. And so there was this kind of elevation of figures like Steve Jobs to an almost godlike status. And if you insisted on having super godlike entrepreneurs and you also wanted a socialist basis for everything, those are clearly incompatible. And the only way to find a resolution was this thing we call the advertising model, where we'd essentially lie and we tell users, oh, it's all for free, share, share, it's all free, it's good to share. But in fact, it was about making money from other people who were hoping to manipulate all those people who were sharing for free in order that there could be a business. And so that's the short explanation of what happened. Of course, the truth is much more complex, and I tried to capture a little bit of it in the book.
Maybe you can talk a bit about the ideas that you have that might be able to fix the problem.
It seems to me that really two potential ways forward. One way forward is to prefer the socialist side of the original orthodoxies and the other is to prefer the capitalist or libertarian side. If we were to prefer the socialist side, what that would suggest is that the internet shouldn't be a business at all, that it should be something more like a public library or public broadcasting, if you like. It should be a public institution that's paid for from taxes and governed through a democratic procedure. That might work. I'll tell you what I'm worried about with it. The reason why I haven't come out and advocated that solution is that the internet gathers so much information about people. I'm quite sure that Facebook has more information on each person than the Stasi did, for instance. And so when you have something that has this kind of information, information is power, I think it creates too much of a temptation for bad actors to take over that thing. And I'm really concerned about that. If companies like Facebook and Google, for instance, were nationalized, that would create a tremendous center of power. And that power would be so tempting that I think it would destabilize the government. That might sound like an extreme position, but I believe it's actually a realistic one. So that's so.
Really? Because, I mean, like, how would that solve things on the international level? Because that might be like a solution on U.S. turf.
No, I think it wouldn't be a solution. I think it would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. I think it would break apart into nation states, probably. I don't, because I think nationalization would be the method that's possible.
Okay.
And honestly, I'm a little concerned that some of the authoritarian or right-wing populist leaders that have been coming into power all over the world might attempt to do something like that. I don't want to name a country, but let's say there are various countries that have an ascendant strongman leadership. And you could see how somebody might say things like Facebook and Google should be part of the state apparatus. They are in China, for instance, also in Russia. So why not in other countries? So I think that's something to be concerned about. So this leads me to my preferred solution, which might not make some people on the left happy, but I think it's ultimately the best solution, even though it's very far from perfect. And that is to make the internet a business, but more like a traditional business, where everyone, whoever uses something is actually the customer of that thing. And whoever provides information into it is a seller. So everybody buys and sells just like in a normal market. So in that case, we have some good precedents for why people would pay for it. For instance, Netflix, a going concern, a reasonably successful business, I would say, in which people pay for something that they actually could technically get for free, but they just find it worthwhile to pay because overall they get enough value. And indeed, many think that the whole genre of TV has been elevated because of people being willing to pay for it. But then the other side of that is that people would be paid. So when somebody creates a post on Facebook or a tweet on Twitter or whatever it is, if it is very successful and drives the value of that platform, they should get paid for it, no matter what kind of data it is. And I think that that's a better future. It not only distributes power and wealth in a way that we're not seeing right now, but it also addresses the problem of loss of employment from automation, which is maybe a bit of a surprising thing. But right now, a lot of people are stressed out that companies like Google are saying, well, our software, our artificial intelligence will drive the cars. So all the people who are currently driving cars or trucks will be out of work. And of course, this is terrifying. But the thing is, in order to run these AI programs, a tremendous amount of data has to be scooped up. An example I like to use is that the automatic translation of English to German requires millions of example phrases to be stolen from people without announcement every single day from around the world. And the reason why is that in order to keep the translators fresh, you have to have new examples to cover things like pop culture and news and slang and memes and all the things that change every day. And so right now we're telling translators, well, you're going out of work because a computer's doing your job. Just look, you can get a free translation. But actually, we still need those people. It's just that we need them in a new way. And we're lying about it. We're trying to pretend they don't have any value so we don't have to pay them. But in fact, if we were honest, we would be paying them. And then they wouldn't be going out of work. They just have a new variation on their job, which would still be dignified and still be valuable. And so this idea of making everything more monetized both addresses, I think, a lot of the problems of power and wealth concentration and the problem of potential unemployment from automation. And also, it addresses the problem of the perverse incentives, because even though it'll still be annoying and problematic, because markets always are, it won't be fundamentally about lying to and manipulating people. It'll be about getting them to pay for the service, which is maybe not ideal, but it's better.
I get the idea that it might be a good idea to take the pressure away from the companies to have manipulation as the basis of their business model. But on the other hand side, there are intellectuals like Yevgeny Morozov who says, like, okay, maybe we're a little late to the game. Maybe the big companies gathered already enough data to have, like, for example, in language, in translation, to have an idea about what how translation would basically work, and the fine tuning, the need for current translations is like such a teeny tiny bit of data that you have to add to this, that it might be like too late to join the game.
Well, I mean, there's several ways to address that. One is they might owe a debt for past data. That would be a very reasonable thing. If there's been theft in the past, it should be corrected for now. It shouldn't stand. If you tell somebody, hey, you stole something 10 years ago, sometimes there's a statute of limitations, but perhaps in this case, there has to be an adjustment. I mean, remember, we're talking about the majority of the most wealthy corporations of all time and the most valuable corporations of our age. And I love these companies. I know that sounds contradictory. I've sold a company to Google and I currently work with Microsoft. And I believe that if we can make the world a better and more functional place, ultimately it's better for the big companies. Winning in a world that you destroy is not any form of winning anybody actually wants. And that's what's going on right now. So ultimately, I think the rational decision is to not destroy the world. So anyway, one way to address it is to treat it as a debt that still has to be paid, or some kind of royalty should be paid based on data that's already been gathered. And this, it might be impossible to derive precisely what data was taken from who, but it could be done approximately. This would be some sort of a statistical version of a truth commission to figure out what happened. Mm. I think it's entirely doable. The second way to address that objection is to say that if we are to believe the amount of the ideas of the people who are investing tremendously in artificial intelligence, and if we are to believe the rhetoric from all the companies doing it and the so-called AI race, there's more to be done with data in the future than in the past, and there's a tremendous desire to get new types of data. The current, for instance, there's currently a drive to get facial expression data and biometric data and medical data. So the thing is, it's impossible to really know what the future will bring, but if we are to believe the current investment patterns, there's actually more data and more value to be gathered from the data in the future than there's been in the past. So at least within the industry, the belief is that there's more in the future than the past, and so the concern is actually not, would turn out to be false. But of course, we don't know if that'll really turn out. The industry might be wrong, and it might be that the data that's already gathered turns out to be the important data forever or something. But either way, I think that doesn't change the fundamental ethical and practical considerations.
Another thing you suggested before is that people should be paid based on their interactions with social media. That's an interesting point, because like one of the problems there for certain is the way the companies process the data and use the data to manipulate us and find more things about us and our behavior, our secret desires and so on. Another one is the problem of fragmentation, of filter bubbles, of polarization. If you pay people based on their social media interactions, wouldn't that mean that you reward people who are just like now tending to gain more emotion, to move more to the extremes, and with this supporting the polarization we see like on the alt-right side, but also like in other spheres?
Well, we have a little bit of an empirical test on this, because we can look at the style of content that has appeared both in present and past systems that were based on direct commerce instead of manipulation commerce. And I want to emphasize that I'm not a utopian. I think any arrangement between human beings will ultimately be annoying, because people annoy each other. And so we shouldn't pretend that we're entering into some sort of perfection. But there's an important difference between being annoying and being an existential threat. And I feel that right now what we're doing is actually an existential threat, because it's making humanity crazy enough that we're not dealing with our real problems like climate change, and we're instead focusing on stupid made-up problems. And so if we wish to pull back from existential threat to merely annoying, which I think is the best goal we can probably achieve. There is evidence that we can do that. As an example, in the era before the internet, when there was a more of a direct commercial model for commercial media, there were definitely tabloid newspapers that used celebrity gossip and crazy stuff to try to get attention or to sell themselves. There were a few radical journals and all these things. And yet somehow on the whole, the mainstream news and mainstream media maintained a grip. And people overall, I think, were better telling the difference between nonsense and the news. And I think that that's a fair statement. It's borne out by all studies about that I'm aware of that have looked at how well people are informed, have seen a decrease in how well people are informed with the rise of the internet business model. So I think I have no doubt that in a direct commerce model, there would be a number of things that I personally find annoying, which would be very prominent. There would be celebrities, but they would be perhaps Kardashian-style celebrities. And I don't know if you know who that is. Right. That's an American. Okay. Versus horrible political things. In order to make money from directly selling things, it's not crucial to put people into a corral and prove that you've changed them in a given way. Whereas if you're trying to get money from a third party, you have to do that because that's the only thing the third party will pay for. So the thing that's better about direct sales is that as long as you get the person to pay, it doesn't really matter if you've changed the way the person thinks or anything. There might be side effects, but they're more diffuse because they aren't directly the same thing as the commerce. And so it actually is better, not perfect, but better.
Let's maybe step back a bit, because I really enjoyed in the Dawn of the New Everything, I really enjoyed the passages where you described like how the internet and the tech world that we know today came to be, like in mm-hmm. the early 80s, describing the scenes at the Chinese restaurants,
oh, yeah.
which gave like an insight into the hacker culture of that time. Mm-hmm. I found it very interesting when you mentioned that you were surprised that the so-called normal people did let those hackers change their world without resistance. And I thought about that for a moment because I thought, okay, do you think that the world, the digital world we see today would be like a nicer one or a better one if the normal people had their say on it?
Yeah, I think there should have been much, much more controversy and strife around the internet in the 80s and 90s. Well, we didn't have an internet in the 80s, but the process that led to it. What happened was this kind of absolute certainty and ideology. Yes, we're going to change the world. And there was very little controversy there. And there should have been a lot of fighting. I mean, this is such a big deal. The idea that we did this so uncritically and we just did it, that idealists just made this thing with so little consideration, I think will be remembered as a gigantic mistake of history. There were all of these idealists, including me, and we just sort of charged and said, we'll do this great thing. We'll do it. It's wonderful. We're doing it fast. It's wonderful. And, you know, Facebook had the slogan, move fast and break things. And there was just this feeling that we couldn't be wrong, that everything would be perfect. And I mean, it's not as bad as it might have been, admittedly. I mean, I don't think we were as bad as many other idealistic movements in history. But the thing is, you can't do something tremendously important for the world with no democratic process at all. And of course, to the people who are true believers, they believe that they are the only thing needed in democracy and anybody else must be a fool. But that's not real democracy. That's just a sort of a tyranny of the most obsessed. And what there should have been is a very serious discussion and maybe experiments, and it should have been much more slow. I mean, because, you know, I mean, we've gotten to this point right now where the internet is, as it originally envisioned, barely exists because everybody interacts with these corporations instead of through the internet. There are many people who don't think in terms of an open internet, but just Facebook or something, you know, and that's not what it was supposed to be. And so I think we did a disservice to the world, and I could make an excuse and say I was complaining more than other people earlier or something like that, but that's really neither here nor there. The truth is that we didn't do a good enough job, and so now, at the very least, we have to do everything we can do to improve it.
I mean, the problem of the homogenic sample of society that actually does make these decisions on tech design is today, in a way, also comparable. I mean, you have like a lack of representation of people from different backgrounds, from females and so on. Would you say that these problems repeat themselves when you look at AI and the use of machine learning, of big data interpretations?
Well, okay, so there are a few different questions built into your question. So I need to break it apart into a few questions. Let me first address one of the things you brought up about the lack of diversity. It's a gigantic, gigantic problem. And in fact, it's arguably the root problem. In our case, it's not exactly, let's say, ethnic lack of diversity. It's more cognitive style. In Silicon Valley right now, if you go into a meeting, a very large number of the people will have been born in India or China or a few other places. So there's a certain kind of diversity, but they're overwhelmingly male. They're overwhelmingly younger. They're overwhelmingly, though, and this is much more important, they have a nerdy mindset. They have a kind of a view of the world that's informed by a certain set of ideas from artificial intelligence and science fiction and a few writers who are interested in an information-centric way of thinking about the world. And so this lack of cognitive diversity is a core problem. It makes everything narrow. It makes everything boring in a way. Okay, so that's one problem. Now, as far as whether we're repeating it, the answer is there's a mixture. I think in medicine and biomedicine, there's a somewhat better system of caution and consideration and planning. It's not perfect, as we just saw with this renegade Chinese scientist who's engineered human babies using CRISPR. But the community is reacting against that. And it's not, that's very different. With the internet, it was just everybody was on board. There wasn't any consideration. There wasn't any conference to say, is this a good idea? There was never a conference to say, is the internet a good idea or maybe it's a bad idea? That never happened. And it's a scandal that it didn't happen. It's an absolute scandal. There were a few critics publishing things. Maybe four or five people were publishing critical essays, and I was one of them. But there was never a conference, but there are bioethics conferences, and they're serious. So it's better. In the case of AI, it's in between. There are a few organizations and a few conferences related to ethics and some talk about it. I personally find a lot of that work on AI to be a little shallow in that it accepts all the definitions and the agenda as given by AI proponents and then talks about how to mitigate the damage instead of challenging whether the whole way AI people are talking might be part of the problem and might be wrong. So they're not as deep as they should be, but at least they're there.
The only technology you seem to be hopeful for is the technology of virtual reality. I mean, in your books, that is something that you have like the biggest hopes for. And I wanted to ask you why, considering the idea that it might be easy to abuse and fuck this idea up too.
The only reason I focus on virtual reality so much in the book is that it's my thing. I mean, it's what I'm in a unique position to talk about it. And I try to make clear in the book all the potential dangers and misuses and how it could have a very dark side. And I try to be as honest as I can about it. But of course, I'm enthusiastic about it. And I actually do really love it. But it would be incorrect to say that it's the only technology I'm enthused about. In fact, in my professional life, I work on many others, and I'm an advocate of many others. And I'm particularly interested in things related to health, to managing peak human population coming later in this century, and most of all, to anything to mitigate climate change and to survive it. And, you know, I'm actually a very pro-technology person overall. It's just that at this particular moment in this context, technology criticism is much more needed. So one has to respond to what the needs are of their time and place.
You've been critical about the way, for example, Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web, constructing it in a way that allows only like one-way links and so on. Now he's moved forward and suggested another way to fix the web or the problems of the web that he used to interpret. Do you have the feeling that this is like too little too late? Is it solutionism, or do you think this might be a good idea to do something?
It can't possibly be solutionism, because solutionism is only a legitimate criticism when there's no need for solution and it's just a constructed thing. There's a genuine problem here with the need for solution. So that would be an inappropriate insult, even if an insult was warranted. I've communicated with Tim about his new project, which is called Solid. My concern here is a little subtle. In my view, what happened is in recent years, as it became clear that the internet was failing society and was doing more damage than good, it wasn't clear conceptually how to address that for many people. And there was a concentration on the idea of privacy and on managing data. And this has expressed itself in many ways, such as the GDPR in Europe. Tim Salad does a number of things, but I would say probably its central focus is on creating a way for people to have control of their own data, even if it's used in a variety of ways, rather than simply sending data to someone else's server and asking that party to be trustworthy. And I think that that's laudable. But in my view, it doesn't address the heart of the problem, because the heart of the problem isn't so much that data is taken, because in that step of taking someone's data, nothing bad's been done yet. If one takes the data and never does anything with it, then there's no harm. It's the way the data is used that's the problem. And even if there's a very careful method of controlling the ownership and the path of the data, and there's some form of consent, if ultimately somebody uses the data in a way that damages the person, that is the damage, you know, and it's almost impossible to foresee in advance what could be done so that consent really isn't that meaningful. So I feel that the right way to address this is by disincentivizing the worst uses of data rather than trying to control privacy or data ownership per se. Obviously, I'm interested in data ownership because I want to create commerce around it. And Tim's idea for the Salad architecture could very well be an excellent strata for introducing commerce based on data. It doesn't have every little thing it would need, but it would do a lot. And he has an organization that's been going around and I think doing a good job of advocating for what they're up to. But to me, it's only one little part of what needs to be done. And the very, very most important part is to change the incentives, because economic incentives will be the biggest determinant of what happens if there's any market at all.
Thank you very much.
Oh, certainly. Thank you so much for being interested.